for WPFW Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe and thank you for listening.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The time now is 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Vantage Point with Ron Daniels, a.k.a. The Professor, coming up.
Good afternoon. This is the Professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, President of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and Distinguished Lecturer Emeritus from York College, Center University of New York, welcoming you to this May 3rd edition, special edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 WBAI, 99.5 FM. That's in New York on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with YCRadio.org. The brother said, A.K.A. the Professor. Give me some love, brother. Strap, tighten that up. Pump it up a little bit. I'm just joking. Well, of course, today is our State of Newark report. We have a special State of Newark report. Usually Mayor Baraka is with us the first Monday of every month. But today we'll be joined by, this is an incredibly important conversation about violence as a public health crisis. And we're going to be joined by Lakeisha Ure, who is the Director of Violence Prevention, the Office of Violence Prevention for the City of Newark, New Jersey. And we've asked Pastor Michael McBride, who is the Director of Urban Initiatives and the Live Free Campaign for Faith and Action, to join us coming out of Berkeley, California as well. There's an interrelationship of this that I'll talk about a bit later. But before we get into that conversation, very important conversation, I just want to say, just heard the announcement in New York as of May 19th, the birthday of Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, 100% cast capacity in restaurants in New York, but if there's social distancing. So there's freedom, COVID-19 freedom, but with limits. And I do think it's so important that we obey those limits. Clearly now people who are vaccinated are supposed to be able to, are able to go out, you know, without masks, outdoors and whatever. A little unclarity because you don't have a mask and you go get ready to go into a building. As I was recently, I kind of panicked because, I got to have my mask on. And fortunately, I had a spare mask in my glove compartment. I am actually going to continue to wear my mask for a while. Just because I just want to wear my mask for a while. I've kind of gotten used to it. Also, people should, if you listen to the science, they say getting herd immunity may be difficult, but it's going to be much more difficult if we don't get people vaccinated as soon as possible. My heart, and I'm sure this goes out to the tragedy. I mean, the apocalyptic tragedy that's going on in India, which is a manifestation of government malfeasance, as much as we experienced under the regime of the orange man in this country. Fortunately, that's no longer the case. That doesn't mean that we don't have some difficulties and some things to deal with, but at least there's a concerted effort to get this thing under control. And what you see in India, mass rallies, big festivals and millions of people without masks, and now paying the price, paying the cost, which means we cannot let our guard down. This is going to be with us for a while. We're going to have to get used to it. It is the new normal that we're going to have to get these vaccinations, some social distancing, this practice. We just got to get used to it so we can have a relatively new normal life. Speaking of tension and anxiety and question of what is normal, one of the questions is there's a lot of just trauma that comes with these kinds of events documented in terms of psychiatry and psychology, which is why we have a community cares listening line. If you are still dealing with issues related to it, and by the way, you know, domestic violence, child abuse, alcoholism, any of these kinds of concerns, call the Community Cares Listening Line, which we are doing in partnership or at least in collaboration with WBAI supporting it. And we're getting great support and feedback that people are calling. It's anonymous and it's confidential. Culturally appropriate listeners will be there if, in fact, you're dealing with after effects, you're dealing with all the issues that that unfortunately can occur even after this is over, the so-called long haul effects. See, even if you recover, a good percentage, so about 30%, will have some kind of lasting effect. And so this will create anxiety and tension as well. So we want you to clearly, you know, call the listening line, 877-827-6677, 877-827-6677. We'll get you into the Community Cares IBW Black Family Summit Community Cares Listening Line. We had a big, and it may have, I think it may have played on WBAI on this last Saturday, but the report card on Biden, the first 100 days, was a spectacular success, hosted by the Honorable Rajay Baraka, Mayor of Newark, and of course, Chokwe Antar Lumumba from Jackson, Mississippi, formidable panel. You can go to the IBW website, ibw21.org, ibw21.org, and you can see the recording. You can see the video again by or for the first time if you choose, or we see it again by going to the website, ibw21.org. Well, I had my premiere appearance yesterday on Open Line as a guest host on Open Line, WBLS 107.5 FM. We had great discussion on a number of issues, including the issue of gun violence and violence in the Black community. I had a really, really rich discussion about that, which is a nice segue to bring our guests for today into the conversation. Delighted to welcome to our microphones for the State of Newark Report Special Edition, first and foremost, Ms. Lakeisha Ure. She is, again, as I said before, the Director of the Office of Violence Prevention for the City of Newark. Ms. Ure, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for having me on the show today.
All right. And also joining us all the way from the Bay Area, who is one of the panelists for the report card on Obama, Pastor Michael McBride. He is the Director of Urban Initiatives and the Live Free Campaign for Faith and Action. Pastor Mike, welcome again to Vantage Point.
Always a blessing to be with you, Dr. Daniels. Glad to be here on this Monday morning.
All right, let's get right into it. Ms. Ure, I wish you would just talk to us about why the designation of healthcare, of violence as a public health crisis, as was recently done by President Biden. Why is that so important in terms of the work that you do?
The designation of violence as a public health issue is very important because it gets us to the very core of the social determinants of health. And so if we are ultimately working from a public health lens, then we can get to the root causes of what's happening, what causes violence, what causes gun violence, what causes domestic violence. And so as we look at the pathology, like people pathologize it, but it's really like the social issues, the mental health issues, the emotional issues, the substance abuse issues are at the core. And if we don't treat those things at the core, then we're going to continue to be in the cycle of violence. And so addressing it from a public health lens ultimately helps us to get to the root causes, and we can begin to do some treatment work for it.
Pastor Mike, the same question.
I believe everything my sister said is correct. I will add, from a governance perspective, it also unlocks the tax base of the American taxpayer at the federal, state, and local level to be used and leveraged to create a more sustainable, healthy, whole, and stable community. Too often, the reality and the challenges of black folks are only addressed through the criminal justice system, through an increase in policing, through a kind of a punitive framework. But if we are indeed addressing gun violence and all of its many forms of violence in our communities as a public health issue, we now have access to health and human services, to mental health, to SAMHSA, addiction, all these resources and disciplines that can be put into the service of healing black people and our communities from the centuries of both state violence and the kind of trauma that creates interpersonal violence.
Ms. Urey, I'm struck by the fact that Mayor Baraka has so prioritized the issue of violence in the community that you are the director of the Office of Violence Prevention. Talk to us a little bit about your office and how it functions.
So it's ultimately the Office of Violence Prevention and Trauma Recovery. And so in the wake of the George Floyd unrest and protests, there was a rallying cry for defunding of the police. And so in that rallying cry, the mayor and other people in the city ultimately came up with that we're going to reallocate some funding from the police, from our public safety department, because most cities or everywhere, public safety has the biggest budget. And so those budgets we needed to, you know, take a look at to see how can we do some violence prevention and intervention programs with some of this funding. And so our public safety reallocated 5% of its budget, but that ultimately included the fire department and emergency management. And so it shows that law enforcement can't be the only answer. They can't get all the credit. They can't be everything. And so we are embedding social workers, case managers, victim advocates into the fold where we can go out with law enforcement and sometimes instead of law enforcement, that we can help de-escalate situations. Under the Office of Violence Prevention and Trauma Recovery, we're going to be housed in one of the police precincts where they're going to give us one of the precincts, in which case the 67 rebellion sparked out of. And so this is restorative practices and restorative justice that we're looking at head on. And so we are reallocating, we're repurposing the building to be able to have it be a place of help and not harm. I mean, we're going to have anti-racism and a hate crimes unit. We have domestic violence, sexual assault, and community violence all under one place where we're going to be doing it from a data collection place. We're going to do it from a data-driven, where are the hot spots, what's happening in our communities. So we're marrying public safety and public health to be able to intervene and go mediate in the community from a boots-on-the-ground place all the way up to a therapeutic place where we have therapists, counselors, people at a doctorate level, all the way down to people who are formerly incarcerated as the interventionalists.
Oh, very impressive. This may be redundant, but I'm going to ask the question anyway, because I know that within the last couple of weeks, under the Safer City Overview, there were a number of police reforms and community engagement initiatives that were announced. Are these the same initiatives, or are there some additional pieces that you want to add to the conversation based on those announcements about community reforms, I mean, police reforms and community engagement?
So these are not the same. These are ones that we came up with based on the need of our city. And so there are other offices of violence prevention and trauma, and not trauma recovery, but just other offices of violence prevention. But it's based on what our city needs. And so we ultimately are going to incorporate some of those things, some of those other intervention programs that's going to be happening nationally. And, of course, that includes the job training. Of course, that includes the educational pieces. But the city here, we're going to be implementing things that are more specific to our city based on need. We do have a hospital-based violence intervention program here in the city, and we have community-based organizations. We have a Brick City Peace Collective where we brought together 16 different organizations and institutions to be able to collaborate, partner, and make the community accountable and these programs accountable to helping our people. So if they are victimized, then they get to get services and get help. If they need to be relocated, whatever it is that they need. Oftentimes, there's so many programs and resources for our, the people who are the perpetrators, but there's really nothing for victims, for the victims or the survivors. And so we need to help both. It's not either or, it's and, but we never really had the funding and the resources to be able to do it. It was just happening through some of our local council people were raising money to be able to help families. Of course, we have GoFundMes, our victims of crime compensation offices, but this needed to be at a different level for accountability. And so we're going to do this locally from the state level. The governor is putting in $10 million statewide for violence prevention programs. And to hear, you know, that the president is putting in upwards of $5 billion. So it's sending the message for us to see that gun violence needs attention and that we ultimately are behind the eight ball on it.
Well, I really hope our listening audience is, I mean, our audience is listening, because this is at the very forefront of reimagining how we address public safety and the very innovative things that are happening in Newark, New Jersey, which is why, by the way, the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, it's not sentimental. I mean, I love the Honorable Raz J. Baraka. I mean, I love him as an individual, but it's not about that in and of itself. It's about the policies and having the examples that people can look at and emulate across the country is why we look at Newark in our terminology as a model city and continue to hold forums and programs and are finding ways to support as much as possible, including having these monthly State of Newark reports where the mayor is our guest. Pastor Mike, I know that you've been working on these issues for a long time, have a vast national network that is engaged. So share with us what the sort of the mission, if you will, of the Live Free campaign is.
Well, we've been working for well over a decade to get the federal government to take seriously the role it has in reducing urban gun violence beyond the scaling up of policing punitive responses related to incarceration that actually cause more harm. I certainly believe the culmination of our work, along with the partners that we work with, that include Erica Ford out of New York and Chico Timmon out of Chicago, and a host of other folks across the country, is seen in this $5 billion that has been set aside. We do think that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of groups across the country working in every community that has a high proportionality of intra-communal violence, black and brown conflicts that rise to lethal force with the play of guns and conflicts. But there are hundreds, if not thousands, of groups who are working every day as peacemakers, as violence interruption prevention specialists, as folks who are trained in public health approaches, who are trained in trauma-related and informed care. But we're doing a lot of this without resources, without a lot of infrastructure. It's a ragtag configuration, if you will, that does not meet the seriousness of the way in which violence in black and brown communities visit too many of us. And so I think we're in a watershed moment. There's a multi-billion dollar sector now, I believe, of violence intervention efforts that can indeed be leveraged by the federal government if our cities can organize ourselves around this vision where the worst conditions of black and brown people don't have to be met with the repression of law enforcement. Mayors like Mayor Raz Baraka and former Mayor Michael Tubbs here in the Bay Area across the country, I think, are providing that public leadership to make sure that we have leaders at the executive level who are willing to very much champion this approach. And so I hope that people who want to join in this effort can go to fundpeacenow.com and join us as we continue to build the capacity of local cities to accomplish what certainly has been done in Newark under the awesome leadership and team of Mayor Baraka and our sister here on the phone and so many others. I know Brother Keela is there, and I think Dr. Fatima works in there. What we've done in Oakland, what has been done in other cities across the country. This is a moment where we can redefine public safety as we know it and center community members in. And I hope we don't allow this opportunity to slip by us.
You've already sort of spoken to this, but I just want to stress it a little bit more that because I've been following your work and know of the vast network. I had the opportunity to attend before COVID a huge, these annual Live Free gatherings that you have, bringing together literally hundreds of gun prevention advocates from all across the country. You had an opportunity to be with you and to know that you've been dedicated to this along with, you know, for many, many years. And so, and I know the Honorable Raz J. Baraka was invited to the Rose Garden. You were there with many other advocates. Just tell us about how significant that is and just sort of how did it feel to finally be in this moment?
Well, I personally didn't make the trip to the Rose Garden. I was on a camping trip with my daughters, and so I decided to forego the flight. But our team was there. The Fund Peace Coalition was there. One of my deputies was there. Members of our Black, Brown, GBP coalition were there. It was historic. Tears came to my eyes when I got the call that that it was happening, because I had been in previous conversations with previous Vice President Biden during the Obama administration, where this was not a pathway forward that they saw as a priority. And so to see now President Biden become a champion of this, it does prove to me that organizing works and that the power of the people is still our greatest tool, particularly when we're unified to achieve systemic and structural results. So I believe that, again, this is a historic moment, but we must translate that into local action and local organizing, build new systems, build new structures that ensure public health approaches to the trauma and violence in our communities is the first response, if not the most robust response. And I think we'll see the violence dissipate because we are not a people who are inherently violent, right? That is a narrative that is white supremacist in nature. I think we just need the opportunity, self-determination, resources, and skill to help heal our people. And I have the greatest confidence that we have the talent. Now, hopefully, we can scale it up with the resources.
Yes, Ms. Urey, I know you've already touched on this, but the only reason I'm being redundant is I happen to think this is a very important moment. So I'm just asking the same question of you, just, you know, how significant it is to have this announcement of $5 billion. I mean, not 5 million, not 500,000, but $5 billion at the national level. And the city of Newark, the state of New Jersey and city of Newark will be able to tap into.
It's groundbreaking and it's game changing. And as I had an orientation today with my staff that's coming in, and I was stressing to them the importance of how we're changing the culture and how we have to seize the time on this, whereas administration changes are very important for us to understand politics, and we have to understand that all politics are local. And so this is groundbreaking because me and Mayor Baraka and others were out there on the forefront fighting for violence prevention, fighting against stopping the violence in the community. We did rallies and protests in the community for 155 weeks in a row. Rain, sleet, snow, we went into every neighborhood where violence was taking place. And we went out there and we, with whatever small resources that we had, and most times it was coming out of our own pockets, to be able to help people to recover and reintegrate back into the community. But we know what those days were like in terms of being boots on the ground. We know what the days were like knocking on doors and trying to help people with no money, with no resources, with no attention, you know, being drawn towards it, because violence in the city communities was just being normalized. And so it became business as usual. And so to see that it's no longer business as usual, to see that those people from the community who've experienced crime and violence are doing it voluntarily, can now be able to possibly be paid, we can now fund a trauma recovery center where we didn't even know what that was, where California had it and other places had them, and we didn't even know what that was. We wasn't talking about trauma. And to now be able to get resources designated towards trauma for us to be able to have some data collection happen, evaluation happen, mobile units, housing, all of those things, because we just did not know how to do it. But it was from a community-based perspective that we were doing it, right? And like he said, it was fractured, no infrastructure in place. And still for some organizations like Mothers of Murdered Sons and Daughters, Hear My Cry, and different organizations like that who are grassroots can now get some resources is game-changing and groundbreaking. And we have to never forget this moment and make sure that we seize the time on it.
Really, really well put. And let me just say in answer of disclosure that the Institute of the Black World 21st Century is really very conversant with these sets of issues. We were able to actually get a trauma recovery center in Washington, D.C., working with our Justice Collaborative there. And this is game changing. It is really, really incredibly powerful in terms of what is being done. And so I'm very excited because these are issues that we have worked on through our drug policy and reform initiative with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. Finally, I just want to tackle a question, Pastor Mike, that you dealt with, and thank you so much for being a part of that powerful report card on Biden, the first 100 days forum that Mayor Raz J. Baraka hosted, and of course our special respondent, Mayor Chokwe Antoine Lumumba from Jackson, Mississippi. But the issue of gun violence and police violence and the sort of the tension that sort of it plays out in our community, where people often, you know, will turn and begin to talk about, you know, black on black crime, so to speak, or however that's designated. And you know, when police are killing our people, then the slogan defund the police has become very popular. And yet you were pointing out that there's a way in which we have to evolve and have to move this conversation forward with the understanding that there are differences, divisions, not negative divisions, but it's not a homogeneous perspective, that different people do have different perspectives. I wonder whether you just sort of restate some of what you did on that or talked about in the forum about that. Pastor Mike, are you there? Hello? Did we lose him? Apparently we did.
I think we lost him.
Oh, okay. All right. Anyway, essentially what he said was that it is so important to put in place, because a lot of people, older people particularly and others, you know, sometimes get frightened when they hear a slogan and they don't understand it. But that notwithstanding, it's really important to put something in place that we really, he's very much in favor of defund the police and all of that means. And as being articulated, frankly, Ms. Urie, as you're talking about it, you're talking about ways in which policing is being reimagined, but you're also talking about putting those structures in place so that people can understand and learn from it and actually be in a position of control. So I was going to ask you to react to that as well. And as we conclude the interview, I can get your thoughts on that as well. I was going to ask you to comment as well. But that was one of the points that Pastor Mike made in the this incredible forum that Mayor Raz J. Baraka hosted on this past Thursday evening. Your thoughts?
Well, I absolutely, you know, believe that those things are important, whereas we have to reimagine public safety and reimagine policing because we know that most of these the systems, right, are rooted in structural racism. And we ultimately really need to, you know, make those points around structural racism, how systems become gatekeepers. And then it perpetuates, you know, we're talking about gun violence and violence. But what we see is the mass shootings that were happening nationally, and that gets the national attention. When it's happening in our inner city communities, then it's business as usual. And so we have to ultimately take that and rally with it in terms of mass shootings, inner city gun violence, and not just gun violence. We need to look at, because it spills over, domestic violence, sexual violence, financial violence, poverty, the economics, police violence, all of those things have to, you know, be looked at. And for them to go down to the garden and for to hear for the first time a president talk about credible messengers and, right. and violence interrupters, right? To hear that come out the president's mouth means that it's trickled down to a place. And so our mayor, Mayor Baraka, was very excited to hear that and to know that that he's going in the right direction with his mission and vision in terms of how we reimagine policing, that our police here in the city of Newark didn't fire a single shot in 2020, right? And so that's major, but a shooting did happen the first day of 2021. But how they now take a look at that to see what could have been prevented, how could that have been de-escalated, how can we, you know, give better instructions, what could we have done differently? And normally those questions don't happen around policing. Police are, you know, the authority figure. They are the structure, the law, right? They enforce in the law. And so we don't really question the methods. And so now the methods are being questioned to see, can we do it better? And they can't do it alone. Law enforcement can't do the work alone. And now looking at others, social workers, case managers, credible messengers, community people, scholars, all of those different people to kind of say, we have to do this together. It has to be a collective impact. That's how we're doing it, from a collective impact approach, from a public health and public safety lens. Like, we have to marry all of these things. It's not either or, it's and. Where we have in the city of Newark, we have police on one side of a building, our domestic violence center, which is named Shani Baraka. And then we have social services on the other side, working collectively hand in hand. We have community-based public safety, and then we have public safety. So my Office of Violence Prevention is community-based public safety, where the people in the community will work with us differently than they will with the police. They'll tell us things that they won't tell the police. And we do have skills in areas that we can intervene. And so this changes the narrative. And we get to tell our own stories now. We get to talk about what happened when we intervened with the 63-year-old woman was shot, or the 5-year-old baby, or the 6-year-old. What did we do from a community-based place versus it being always a law enforcement narrative? And how do we get the credit? And how do we, you know, tell those stories so that we can get credit for decreasing crime and violence? The law enforcement officer was there, but I was there too.
Right.
We were at the scene together. We went to, you know, we intervened together. I had some information. I helped them to understand the community dynamics. This person was shot by the police before, so you can't handle that person the same way because he's going to fight you. This woman was raped, and she don't want a male officer to approach her. Please don't send in a male officer. You know, just different things and how we approach law enforcement and having another person who can kind of intervene and be a listening ear and a soundboard and be respected in this work. People who are formerly incarcerated, people who know the streets, people who know, you know, the neighborhoods, their voice has to be equally a part of the conversation. They have to be at the table and not just outside of the room. So it's collaborative, and it's a way where we don't go separate. We are working together. We are married. The law enforcement and community-based public safety is a marriage.
Right. Well, Ms. Lakeisha Urey, so impressive, so powerful. The work is amazing. I can't say enough about the notion that Mayor Baraka put out. I say this over and over again when he said, when I become a mayor, we become mayor.
Yeah.
Putting the onus on letting people know that you don't walk on water. This happens because of the kinds of collective engagement that you're articulating, the openness to it, the tapping into the people, listening to the people, engaging the people in a way that, again, I believe is a model. And we hope to continue to spread that model. There are people who are listening to this radio show across the nation. And by the way, how do people who might want to become engaged, how can they do that? Is there a website? Is there a phone number that you can direct people to in order to get involved with your department?
Sure. So the city has a website, so City of Newark, you know, website, and there may be a tab under there that may say Violence Prevention or Shani Baraka Center. But if you go on a website, They can certainly direct you to the Office of Violence Prevention. Also on email, last name Uri, E-U-R-E-L, at ci.newark.nj.us. And the City Hall number, I'll just give the office number to the mayor's office, is 973-733-6400. And so we're currently working out of the mayor's office under the mayor's administration until our building, the precinct, will be ready. So we are working collaboratively with law enforcement, and they are excited, and they are inviting us to their ComStats, and they're helping us to unify our paperwork the same as their paperwork. So law enforcement here is actually embracing this merger or us working together.
Well, that's what happens when you have leadership from the top. Let's give that last phone number one more time so that we people who can call that the office, the 973 number. Would you repeat that one more time, please?
973-733-6400. 973-733-6400.
All right, Ms. LaKeisha Urie, thank you so much for taking time out of your very, very busy and incredibly important responsibilities to spend time with us here on the special edition of State of Newark Report. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Daniels. Have a good day.
All right. Oh, that was like, I hope people enjoy it. I hope that was rich. That was full. All right. We're going to go to our phones now. We wanted to leave enough time for our audience to call in. And we have two basic questions we want you to address. Now, we want you to be the, to respond in either one or both. And again, a minute and a half maximum, 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. Would you grade the Biden administration's first 100 days? Again, some of you heard the forum on WBAI, I think last Saturday. Certainly some of you saw it live on the IBW website and other platforms. Thousands of people watched it. And you can go to the IBW website, ibw21.org, in order to see it if you have not already seen it. So grade President Biden's first 100 days in terms of your expectations, lack thereof, or whatever. You're free to comment and rapid fire. Second is, how would you or how should we treat violence in the Black community? How should we treat violence in the Black community? You have heard, you know, Pastor Michael McBride talk about it. You've talked about Ms. LaKeisha Urie, again, the Office of Violence Prevention and Trauma Recovery. Let me get that full title in there. And so, and you might even comment on what you've heard. Were you impressed by this? Is this the right direction? How should we be moving in that regard? Again, we want to invite you to call 212-209-2877. Let's go directly to our phones. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Good afternoon, Professor. This is Dijon, like the mustard. How are you, sir?
All right, I'm good.
Good. You and I have crossed paths with mutual associates such as Janice Mathis, C.T. Vivian, and as well as our dear brother, attorney is Jonas Williams. I met him in Atlanta in 2015 while he was trying to get to the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. I assisted him in trying to get there as far as getting the taxi. We met on the MARTA bus of all places.
All right. All right. So your comments are either on Biden's first 100 days or the question of how we should be treating violence in our community. Your observations.
Yes, sir. I can do both. Violence in the community. Well, we have what is called, most of us in the Black community, we have what is called, some folks may look at us and say, okay, that's Black on Black. But as you see it, how are we perceived at as far as, you know, for example, I use myself. I dress professional. I dress business casual. So I recall back in 2009, I had a meeting with Janice Mathis and another gentleman, Checkmate Orrin Hudson here in Atlanta, with a Rainbow Bush Coalition, Reverend Jackson's summit. And they used me as an example, saying, okay, if you all seen somebody like Dijon, would you get intimidated, scared, or what have you, as far as how I was perceived as dressed? Like, some individuals may have their pants sagging. I don't do that. But it's all about how we are perceived, like, as far as the police. With that being said, when we see the police, you know, are we going to be shot at? Are they going to talk to us any kind of way? It's all about our presentation.
Right, right. So you heard the presentation of our speakers today. Do you think they're going in the right direction in terms of police reform, police accountability, and whatnot? Because I got to move on to the next caller. So were you impressed?
I believe they headed in the right direction.
All right. So you're calling us from Atlanta, are you?
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay. Appreciate that. Thank you so much. Really appreciate you. And yeah, I do know Janice Mathis, and she was in our previous town hall meeting, by the way, when we did the post-election. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Others can call at 212-209-2877. Great Biden on his first 100 days, or your thoughts about what you heard about the public health approach, or do you have a different approach? What would you add to it? What are your opinions about how we should treat violence in the Black community? 212-209-2877. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, Biden gets a hard F. Not even playing around with it, he gets an F. He has done nothing for the Black community since he's been in. Nothing.
Let me ask you a question. Have you been listening to the interviews that we did?
I
want you to stop there. Did you listen to the two people who were on the air who were talking about various programs? For example, does he get an F because he's been able to deliver $5 billion to deal with people on the ground in a way that's never, ever been done before?
Now, you asking a question. You can't tell me how to answer it. I'm telling you.
No, I'm asking you to respond to that specifically, because what we have very often is people have...
All right, yo, this is Africa from North. I'm going to let you know who I am. I'm on the streets. I'm on the streets every day. That money, whatever they're doing, goes nowhere to people on the streets, on the front lines out here suffering. So you ask me a question. Has Biden done anything in his 100 days? Nothing squat. While he's doing stuff for other people, while he's signing Asian bills, signing bills for other things, he has done nothing for Black people. Now you ask me about what you call about violence in the community. Yo, the violence in our community, scientifically, it's a product of white supremacy. The
we know that.
White supremacy, the institutions of white supremacy in our community dictating our lives. That's why we have the violence in our community. And if we want to change it, we have to do what our ancestors already told us and stop shucking and jiving and being in the same room with oppressors. We have to build our own institutions to dictate how our people live. And we have the money, we have the resources. But we are just not...
I got you. So tell us, give us the information of the organization that you're working with so people can connect with you. What organization are you working with? And give us the contact information, please.
I'm with the New Africa Black Panther Party. It's located...
Okay, and how do people reach you? Can you give people so they can get with you with the programs that you're doing?
You say what?
I said, I want to be able, since you're doing work in the community, I want to make sure that people who agree with you have an opportunity to contact you. Is there a website or is there a phone number so that people can contact you to help build out the program that you're working on?
All right. My name is Africa. My number is 862-283-9918.
All right. Thank you. Really appreciate it. All right. Appreciate it. 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, hi. I thought the show was excellent, first of all. And additionally, I'm very impressed with the first 100 days of the Biden administration. But something that wasn't discussed that I think is really, really important is how to get the guns off the streets, out of people's possession, how to seed that with federal money, the programs. But additionally, I think a way to really get it rolling would be to have the companies that manufacture these guns fund the remedies, just like what's going on with the opioid crisis.
Right.
I didn't hear much about that, and the guns are everywhere.
They are. I agree, but the guns are worse. The gun lobby, whether it's the National Rifle Association, which seems to be in disarray, but it doesn't really matter. There's this gun lobby and this mentality in America, which I frankly believe is driven by white supremacy, a fear of black people and brown people with guns. And going back historically, there's this notion that we have to have the militia prepared for the dangerous black people. But suing the gun lobby or the manufacturers is certainly an idea that it should be on the table. But also, just mustering enough resolve. There are basic reforms that the American people support overwhelmingly, but yet we have gridlock in Washington. So at the end of the day, I'm hoping in this moment that the Biden administration will be able to persuade a Joe Manchin and the woman from out in Arizona, forgive me for that, her name will come to me in a moment.
That's all right.
Who are the kind of the holdouts who don't want to blow up the filibuster or who don't want to use reconciliation over and over again. They're more impressed with bipartisanship, but frankly, people can't eat bipartisanship. People want results.
And you know, the fears of people who have guns for nonviolent reasons, like hunters, we have a hunting culture in the United States. People who hunt, some hunt for, sustenance, some hunt because they like to. But you know what they say in upstate New York? When Obama was elected, for instance, President Obama is going to come and get your guns.
That's
and
right.
Those are not the people whose guns we need to get. But
that's right. Well, and I think,
need to be collected. And of course, if you would offer a sufficient amount for guns, people might turn them in. You don't want to offer so much that people go buy guns to turn them in.
Right. Gun buyback program.
Sufficient amount
right.
for guns so people turn them in. And again, I'm going to repeat it. This comes from the gun industry. We manufacture more weapons than any country in the world.
Absolutely.
How the hell do these get out there on the street? And
right.
So they really should be paying, just like we found that the opioid industry was killing people by gaming the doctors. We've got to find a way. And the NRA is an organization that's totally misinformed.
Right.
They don't care really about urban gun violence or even rural gun violence.
Right.
Their big thing is hunters and people who are right-wing who want to keep their weapons. Well, those people, unless they're right-wing terrorists, those people really are people who should who shouldn't be threatened, shouldn't feel threatened.
All right, my friend, I got you. We got to move on to our next call, but I appreciate your perspective. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Let's go to our next caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello,
you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Oh, yeah. I'm giving Biden a high grade for his first 100 days. I mean, you got obstructionists in the Democratic Party, Joe Manchin down in West Virginia, and another one, his partner, are trying to block just about everything.
Yeah, her name is Christian Sinema. I that the person from Arizona, the woman legislator, Christian Sinema, is her name. Go right ahead. I'm sorry.
I heard your first lady on there with her program for drug violence. I was very impressed. And it pays to have a person at the top making decisions like the mayor over there, as opposed to what's going on here in New York City, But I'm very impressed, and I'm hoping that, that what she put down can spread over into our community. And
yes.
It looked like to me, in our community, it looks like, I don't know, how can we get these young guys to tell them that, having a gun isn't a badge of honor, and they seem to think that, they listen to these, unfortunately, some of these rap songs, they perpetuate violence. They talk about shooting up the community. But I'm hoping that the program she has can spread over to other communities. Thank you. I'm glad talking about this. We need it.
Really appreciate it. And by the way, it is working, and incredible messengers, and I point to East New York over and over again. East New York has a program, powerful program called Man Up. Andre Mitchell is the one who's running that program, and they have kept violence and murders to, in some instances, almost zero because they're out in the community. They're already doing the kind of work that has been anticipated. Erica Ford as others. And again, you've heard the tremendous programming and the vision of the work being outlined in Newark, New Jersey, and also the work of the Live Free campaign by Pastor Michael McBride. Let's go to our next caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Hi. Always, always very, very intriguing and very important programming. Thank you so much, Bob Law.
Well, this Bob Law is my dear friend, but this is Dr. Ron Daniels, a.k.a.
Right,
the
Ron
professor.
I'm sorry. I'm a listener.
It's okay.
For years
Bob Law is my dear friend. I could be called worse than Bob Law, that's for sure.
Well, you're equivalent. You know, you go to the heart of the matter. For me, not only did I work the elections and I was with my people, I was so proud of them, and I did vote for Biden. But however, I just feel all along with these attacks with voting and how many more people have to die at the hands of police, that I feel especially it's like in our face every day that, you know, the pandemic, you know, emergency actions. How come there's no emergency action? So I'm disappointed. Like he said, I got your back. No, you don't, because you should declare this an emergency. Why do our people have to
wait? Now, hold on a minute. Let's just talk about this.
First of all, we're being attacked by our children.
Hold on. Now, when you say declare it a state of emergency, I mean, the president Biden has issued a number of executive orders, some of which have to do with policing. But there is also a George Floyd police.
No, I know about that.
That bill is, and he has asked that it be passed by the Congress of the United States by May 25th, the anniversary of George Floyd's unfortunate public lynching. Now, he cannot
just
wave
like
a magic wand. Excuse me.
Hold on,
please. I want to reason with you for a minute.
Okay.
He cannot just wave a magic wand and make Congress do that. But he is trying.
But sometimes I feel like the Democrats should be a little gangster the way Trump was. And what I mean by that.
But here's what I want you to do. I want to get beyond the. I want to get beyond the slogans for a minute. When you say gangster, the way the gangster would be. To bust the filibuster and pass it by that. But on the other hand, you unfortunately, not because of Biden, though he has some reliance, you have Joe Manchin, a Democrat, and you have Kristen Sinema, a Democrat, who are not willing to do it. So in a way, it's difficult. So we have to also appreciate the complexities of the moment. I appreciate your frustration, however. I feel the same frustration. But we are making some progress because you went to those polls and you voted and people marched on ballot boxes. And if we don't seize this moment, it's going to be really terrible because the obstructionists are going to win. I got to move on. Let me get my next. I'll get one more caller in. Appreciate it. And we'll pick this up next week. Let me get one more caller in. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
No more callers.
Okay, all right, we ought to call this. But anyway, I took a little extra time there because, folks, we got to get beyond just the slogans and examine and unpack things. That does not mean that we'll agree or that we'll have the same opinion. But to just simply say across the board, well, you know, he should declare a state of emergency and so forth. I mean, We got the John Lewis voting rights bill ready to move forward. DC statehood has been passed by the House of Representatives to the Senate. Reparations is about to be voted on by the House of Representatives and may well be signed into law by executive order by President Biden. And if you heard the activists talk about, and by the way, this is the victory for the Bernie Sanders campaign. This is the victory for the people's movement. I mean, you have to have somebody who's willing and who's willing to listen, but that listening is also a function of the fact that people got out there and demonstrated in the streets and they marched on ballot boxes. And there's a huge opening here, and we need to seize that moment. We are so used to losing that when we see victory, we just, it's like, we just can't believe it's, we're winning. So it's a proverbial, is the glass half full or half empty? We too often want to see it half empty. I see this administration so far, and I'm going to be in there, whatchamacallit, but it's three quarters full in a way that is almost unimaginable. And AOC, of all people, AOC came out and she said, I'm shocked. Cornel West, I'm shocked. And these are not people who are just like used to just giving people a pass. At the degree that sleepy Joe Biden is making sweeping, bold efforts towards change, but is being obstructed by white nationalist, white power. And so we got to figure out how to overcome that barrier. Anyway, have enjoyed your engagement. Wish we had a little bit more time. Maybe we'll expand it and get a little bit more time to engage here on Vantage Point. But again, we thank you for listening. We'll see you again here next week. Coming up next is the news on WPFW, WBI. Donita Samuels, I assume, will be picking up from here.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The Pentagon has begun the process of canceling contracts for border wall construction that used funds diverted from other Defense Department accounts by the Trump administration. Trump had diverted about $10 billion from military construction accounts and counter-narcotics programs to pay for hundreds of miles of steel barriers along the Mexico border, an effort that President Joe Biden has denounced as wasteful and ineffective. A Biden administration official said in a statement that, to the extent possible, what remains of the more than $14 billion tied up in border wall projects would be restored for use as Congress intended. In a separate statement made Friday, the Department of Homeland Security said it would use congressionally appropriated funds to repair flood levees in the lower Rio Grande Valley that had been damaged during border wall construction. The United States will begin reuniting migrant children with their parents this week, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas said today. Four families that were separated at the Mexico border will be reunited in the United States this week in what Mayorkas says is just the beginning of a broader effort that will stretch on for months and possibly years as separated parents are brought back to the United States from around the world. More than 1,000 families remain apart, according to DHS. The parents were deported alone, mostly to Central America, in 2017 or 2018. Their children have since grown up with relatives across the United States. Immigrant advocates welcomed the announcement, but expressed frustration at the slow pace of reunification. The Environmental Protection Agency is taking a major step today to battle climate change with the formal proposal of a rule phasing down the use of planet-warming gases called hydrofluorocarbons, which are used in air conditioning and refrigeration. The reduction will decrease HFC production and use in the United States by 85% over the next 15 years. Unlike many of the administration's other climate initiatives, there's broad bipartisan support for curbing HFCs, which are thousands of times more potent greenhouse gases than carbon dioxide. This will be the first time the federal government has set national limits on HFCs. More than a dozen states have either banned HFCs outright or are formulating some restrictions. In Minnesota, Attorney General Keith Ellison and state prosecutors are seeking a severe sentence for former Minneapolis cop Derek Chauvin after a jury found him guilty in the murder of George Floyd. In paperwork filed with the judge on Friday, Ellison asked for an aggravated sentence on behalf of the state. Without an aggravated sentence, Chauvin could end up serving a minimum of just 2.5 years for his violent crimes. In making his case, Ellison cited several factors, including Floyd's vulnerable position on the ground, that he was treated with particular cruelty, Chauvin's abuse of authority, the presence of at least 4 children, and that Chauvin, quote, committed the crime as part of a group of 3 or more persons who all actively participated